Welcome to Bare Naked Money, the podcast where we strip down the complex world of finance to its bare essentials with your hosts, Josh Shellick and Colin White, portfolio managers with Varakin Capital Management, Inc.
Colin and Josh here, Bare Naked Money. We're here to give you some quick hitters on the market and news cycle for this week. What are you looking at, Colin?
Well, the date is April the 19th, which if we're going to call this quick hitters and timely, we probably should give that information. I was terrified the other night when my phone news feed came up that there was more missiles flying across the Middle East, and Iran may or may not have been involved. Nuclear sites may or may not have been involved. That news is truly terrifying. I don't know. Well, you're probably distracted with other things, but did you see the news hit at in real time as that was going on?
Yeah, I was getting the live feed from Bloomberg on that. So I saw it happening. Are we getting numb to the whole this person attacked that person, this country attacked that country? Are we getting numb to that yet?
I think there's a case to be made that the financial markets have numbed to that. But I think that the bigger point is the financial markets have always been somewhat numb to that. And again, I don't want for a second to minimize the human cost of what's going on. It is a tragedy, and it's an unmitigated horror story in every possible description. But we're here in your world to give you financial advice. And a couple of points to be made. None of this is you can make a decision on. You can't anticipate these things. And after they happen, they're already done. What you need to do is accept the fact that this shit's going to keep going on. Like this is reality. And if somehow this makes you too uncomfortable, then maybe you shouldn't be investing. But I think there's a good solid track. I was thinking the other day, Josh, back over what's going on in the last 5 years. What are all the major events of the last 5 years?
We've had global conflict or just events just in general,
Things we thought that would actually upend the market. So we had a pandemic.
Yep.
You know, we had Donald Trump storming the White House to stay in power. We had Russia invade Ukraine, or sorry, special military operation. Then we had, Gaza and, what's going on in Israel. Now we've got Israel going at it with Iran.
Yeah.
Is the market up or down for the last 5 years?
Well, it's up a lot. And there's probably some that you overlooked there. We didn't talk about China and Taiwan or the war of words, between China and the U.S. or anything with North Korea. We haven't even talked about North Korea in 2 years, it seems, which I guess we'll count that as a win, right?
And we also had inflation go to double digits or almost double digits and come back. Like all of this has occurred in the last 5 years.
Yeah. And Market's up.
So, that's not saying that it's always going to be up, but I do think that it's a really great case study to point out you might not be paying attention to the right ship.
Yeah.
The things that are truly horrific and truly terrifying and seeming to be truly important from a market return perspective, maybe are not as important as the way people know them.
Yeah. And certainly market reaction this week from the Iran-Israel conflict has been muted, if anything.
But the other point to make, I think, is that it's also not monosyllabic. It's not one thing. Like, you don't look at one event and that's what the market's going to react to that day.
Yeah.
I mean, we had this conversation earlier about the Canadian budget and people asking about the Canadian budget effects on the Canadian economy. Well, the missile hitting Iran probably is going to do more to oil prices, which is probably going to do more to the Canadian market than any perception of what the Canadian budget is going to do. So you can say the budget was maybe not good for business in Canada and therefore maybe tangentially not good for the market. But that's not going to be all that affects the market movements in a day. Mm-hmm. There's going to be other headline items and there's going to be other byline items or subline or rest of line items. I don't know. I hate when I get partway down a road and I can't bail. I don't know how to continue that metaphor.
So from conflicts and budgets to something that's a little bit more close to home when it comes to markets, inflation, we've seen consistent numbers coming out so far this year, kind of coming to head the last couple of weeks where inflation's been stubborn is the word of the day, stubborn inflation. And we've seen interest rates come up quite a bit, I'd say, since the start of the year. In Canada, I was looking today, the 10-year bond's up about 65 basis points from the start of the year. So this is material. We're seeing material moves. And I think you said earlier that it just seems that people are pricing in maybe more reasonable expectations of interest rate cuts that are coming this year.
The fairy tale of the rate cut seems to be getting long in the tooth because we've been certain of rate cuts now going on 18 months. There was almost this logic bomb that everybody said is like, well, rates go up, they must come down. I'm like, no, they don't. Rates go up and then data happens and then future decisions are made as to where rates should go. It's not a zero sum game. They go up, they must come down. And I mean, I've been absolutely gobsmacked with the strength of some of the numbers coming out of the US. And I haven't seen anybody come close to projecting the kind of strength that the numbers are indicating. And that's that has a whole bunch of ramifications for Canadians. You know, we're going to be in a situation where we might be cutting rates before the US, which is not good for the loonie, and it's already getting priced in. Sorry, yep, this isn't going to help you. But you know, this is going to turn into a currency conversation, which TIFF hasn't really been addressing yet. And at a certain point, it's going to be, you got to defend the currency. That's when he really gets into a sticky wicket, as they say. It's like, well, the economy needs to be to cut rates, but how we don't want to make the currency, because you know, that'll be, you know, inflationary. So, you know, I wouldn't want his job.
Yeah. And certainly we were looking at the budget earlier this week, and that hasn't seemed to help his job either. So throwing a lot of rocks at him at the moment and seeing if he can dodge them.
Okay. Now remember, we're staying away from social commentary, political commentary, right? We had the conversation about how, you know, the first year economic students really disappointed, but the first year poli sci assignment students probably very happy with the budget. You know, there's different ways to score it.
Yeah, that's for sure.
Welcome to the magnificent, the one, the only, the 2024 budget palooza. Anyway, we thought we would hit record, and here with Josh and Matt, two regular contributors to the Varican Voice. We've been having some great conversations about the budget, which surprisingly had a lot in it, and we thought we should share some of that with everybody. So, capital gains inclusion. Who would have thought?
Like the boy who cried wolf almost, eh? Who's like, year after year, we think that this is going to be included, and then you never have it. And just when we think that it's never going to be included, sure enough, they hit us over the back of the head with it.
The headline news is not quite as bad as the details, do you think, Matt?
Yes, when you dive into the details, I think that's when you really find out they went in the direction that I wasn't expecting them to. And I think a bit to that boy called wolf. This was the year I almost had my back up the least for it. No. You know, the last few years was having more conversations around it. This is something to be mindful of. This year was a year of, no, it can't happen this year. If they haven't done it by now, I think we're safe. And we were hit with it.
Yeah, but again, I don't think we were hit with it as much as we could have been hit with it. So they've just increased the inclusion from 50% to 2/3, which is material, but they've also put some limits on it. And an individual can still have up to $250,000 of capital gains per year and not attract the new inclusion rate, which is a big deal. But you know, that's not the same for all other inclusion rates for different structures.
Yeah, so corporate accounts, corporations, trusts will immediately from $1 be hit with the higher inclusion rate. So it is definitely material for those. For the individuals, like you said, Colin, not until you get above $250,000 of capital gains in a calendar year are you going to be hit with this. So for the most part, even if you have regular capital gains on your investment portfolio, for most people, most of us, it's not going to see an impact whatsoever. I think it's more of those one-off situations where your quote-unquote average person might see an effect where you're selling a cottage or selling a second property or potentially selling a business or something like that. That's where I see this having the most material impact. Do you think that's fair, Matt, or are there other aspects where you think that this is going to definitely have a material impact for a large number of people?
I think that's fair, you know, in the average case, but then, you know, when we think to the business owners in our community who I like to see as our peers, our average people, they're being hit in a different way. I mean, the planning for a business owner has, you know, for the longest time, largely been, you know, once your business gets to an established point, you're likely trying to keep more value in your business, whether through the operating or the holding company. And that's mm-hmm. part of your retirement plan. And now those people they're now set with a higher inclusion rate than, you know, the average person. And that's going to be material in many cases. I think we'll have to rethink some planning and around the business owner.
The only other thing that we haven't mentioned yet, I want to make sure we get on the record, is none of this is in force until June 25th. So there is a period of time here that, you know, people can react. And this is, you know, Josh, you and I had this conversation for a few years now, previous budgets, as to, yeah, the capital gains inclusion rate may change, but if they do, then it's not going to be a retroactive thing. So that part's kind of come true. That, you know, there is a little bit of a last kick at the can that you can have. But to Matt's point, yeah, this is a tremendous, potentially a tremendous changer when it comes to the planning aspect of things. Mm-hmm. Josh, to take you back, I mean, Josh was quoted in in the Wall Street Journal today, or was interviewed by the Wall Street Journal about the impact of the budget on the Canadian markets. Josh, do you want to revisit that conversation with everybody?
Well, yeah. So we've had, I think one of the reasons why we're doing this conversation, having this conversation now, is we've had a few sort of knee-jerk reactions or knee-jerk questions, if you want to call it that, asked of us from not only clients, but media personnel as well. And the media personnel to me asked today, what's this going to do for the Canadian equity market? And I said, well, probably not a whole lot of anything. It's just not that material. Material yeah. on an individual basis, but on a big picture level, probably not so much. I don't think people are going to stop investing in Canadian stocks because potentially a higher inclusion rate is going to hit them. I don't think there's going to be less incentive, maybe very slightly at the margin, but not less incentive for businesses or corporations to invest in profitable projects just because there's going to be a slightly higher capital gains inclusion rate. So yes, a very fine margin or very thin margin, it's going to have an impact, but I can't imagine it's going to be hugely material for the market at large, and not in a way that it's going to actually move the market in any way, I don't think.
I'd be curious about that, though, because when you think about the next 2 months that we have for some planning to occur, and some of the areas where a lot of wealth has been built in the stock market, think your long-held positions in BCE, your long-held positions in some utility companies, for those that are there to collect the income, and there might be a looking at of those positions, you know, between it might be a, well, if I held to my estate value, it might be this, or if I pay the taxes today, it becomes a slightly lesser value that goes out of the door. So at that margin, there may be an increase in just outflow, though it may be repurchased immediately, and then we see a bit of a wash. So it may ultimately be a sort of in and out type transaction.
Well, I think you're dead on, Matt. I think some of those conversations absolutely should happen, because you're looking at like close to an 8% increase in tax payable, which is that's material. But to Josh's point, I don't think that it's material in the overall market, you know, as far as like moving the entire equity market. I would be surprised. I don't have any data to back that up, but I would be surprised if it was material enough to cause any kind of an equity market reaction in any kind of a major way. I think that, you know, budgets don't really have, because we live in a democracy, a budget's not going to do something that's going to tank the market, at least not knowingly, because then that's going to get people, you know, unelected. It's more likely that there would be a really good news budget that would be positive for the overall Canadian economy and therefore cause a bit of a bump in the market. This certainly wasn't that budget. But it's odd. I was flabbergasted, Josh, to be honest. That was the question that was asked of you, because it's not the only time that question has been asked today. There's a real concern that somehow this was going to tank the Canadian market. And I had to stop for a second and just try to follow the logic. But I can't back that up. I can't see it as being a big deal.
Yeah, well, as Matt said, there are probably some individual situations where maybe it makes sense to take some capital gains now and sell a position, right? I think that's true. And I think that's factually true. I don't think that's debatable. But the thing where I think there's a couple more areas or shades of gray is, if you're deciding to take the capital gains hit now, you're accelerating your tax payable. So there's a clear trade-off here as well. You might pay a slightly lower inclusion rate over the next 10 weeks or whatever it is, but you're paying the tax now versus deferring it to some point in the future, which everybody individually is going to make that determination for when that would be. So if you plan to die on August 1st, then yeah, you should probably make the change now. But if you don't know when you're going to die, like most of us, then, or are unclear when you're going to sell asset X, whatever it is, shares of BCE or your cottage or something else, then it's less clear to me that there'd be any advantage whatsoever of accelerating that tax hit.
Well, then, you know, if you're going to get to portfolio management, I'll throw out the whole idea about properly allocating a portfolio. And if you're holding onto a legacy position, that's maybe not the strongest investment. But then we get on the merry-go-round, and it's going to take us longer than we have here, right, Josh?
Matt has 20 minutes. He was very clear about that.
But to that portfolio construction piece in a taxable account, especially when you think about the role of capital gains and on an after-tax basis, it's been one for 20 plus years of capital gains, or that's the most tax favorable, place to be. The math is slightly different now. dividends have, you know, the dividends have encroached a bit there on an after-tax basis. So can it, it just, there's a lot of areas where the math is different now when it comes to planning, just on this one adjustment. And so, I mean, I'm still digesting. I was laying in bed last night. Just wait a minute. What about this? And what about this? Yeah. So I'm not there yet in terms of all the areas, because we're so used to thinking about things under this one regime, but it's slightly different now. And now what?
To a certain extent, that we're letting people watch how the sausage gets made, because that the dividend inclusion, like that's specific to Canadian dividends as well. Right? So foreign income is different as well, right? So how much do we really care about a Canadian dividend income, you know, in a properly diversified portfolio? This bunny trails off for sure. My true absolute terror right now is, and we've already had calls come into the office where this doesn't really affect anything in people's lives, but they're panicked.
Yeah.
That this is going to push a bunch of people to be susceptible to questionable tax planning strategies, because fear is going to find a home, and people get afraid. Then, you know, somebody's going, "Hey, you heard about those inclusion rates? I can fix it. You should do this." And again, tax planning fraud is like, it's always been a bad thing, but I think this is going to really open up the floodgates and create a whole bunch of people stampeding towards the cliff. There's going to be more than enough, you know, promoters out there that are going to promote things and start suggesting strategies that are not well understood, well thought out, and cause a lot of harm. So I think there's a real, I think that's my biggest fear coming into this budget, is going to cause that kind of stampede.
Yeah. One other thing I think we should get on the record is just what the inclusion rate actually is. So just to give an example for everybody, because I think it's often misunderstood, it's not an actual explicit increase in the tax rate on capital gains. What it is if you have $100,000 of capital gains, for example, you would have had to, in the past, or up to June 24th of this year, include 50% of that as taxable income. So if you have $100,000 of capital gains, you're reporting $50,000 of taxable income, taxed at whatever your marginal tax rate is. This change increases that inclusion rate to 66 2/3% or 2/3 overall. So instead of reporting $50,000 of taxable income, you're reporting $66,667 of taxable income. So just to make sure that that's clear, because it's a hard kind of nuanced concept for some.
Yeah, the other group, and I think Matt alluded to it, but the other group out there that's being affected, and this group that's had a few hits, is there are those people who have gone into retirement or built their financial independence on real estate, where they've picked up a few rental properties and all of a sudden they got shut down. They couldn't do short-term rentals anymore. And then they went long-term, and then there was rent controls went in and they couldn't raise the rent. And then interest rates went up and they were kind of screwed with that. These people are the kind of people who on sale of assets could generate more than a $250,000 capital gain in a year. So this is just another notch against those people. And hate to be the kind of, and we've been talking, Josh and I have been talking about this for years now, about the danger of overemphasizing an asset class or strategy in your situation. Like if your whole life is rentals, or that's where you've built the vast majority of your wealth because you understand it, this is yet another blow to that strategy that's going to make it less effective, more painful, and be more complicated from a planning perspective. So it was funny, the different reactions we had. Ainsley on our team, who produced our market minute today, was like, "Hey, budget came out, we're all good. Market's not going to do anything." Matt went the other direction with it, Liz hair on fire, and went to all of the planning that was coming out of it. And both reactions, I think, are true. Matt, you're absolutely right.
Yeah.
This changes the planning. This is a huge, it's a bigly budget when it comes to the changes it's going to cause on planning side. On the market side, maybe not so much.
Yeah, well, I mean, as much as we never let the tax planning drive the investment strategy, it's probably item two is the tax planning. And so it's very important to all of these, or item three, you know, it's way up there. So it matters a lot to many of these plans. And when we haven't touched a whole lot on trusts, but, you know, those get utilized in Nova Scotia, especially in Ontario as well, where probate rates are so high, to bring in the usage of an alter ego trust, a joint partner trust, and do so to largely to avoid that probate piece, often for privacy, and there are other advantages of it. Well, now to any asset sitting in those structures, you've got a new way you're going to be taxed. And so does that change, you know, I've thought about it before, is there's maybe a floor of, you know, non-registered assets that you should have before thinking about that structure. Does the floor jump now? Does the math just say, it's only appropriate now in a case of a higher value. And maybe that's the case. So there's a lot of this on a planning perspective that just changes immediately when the math changes.
Yeah. What's everybody else's favorite thing other than capital gains inclusion rate that they saw in this budget? What's the best of for you guys?
On a positive basis, the clarification maybe around AMT and the alternative minimum tax and allowing for more charitable giving with the deduction to the donor, I think is good to clarify and hopefully good for charities as well to ensure that people don't sort of backtrack on maybe where they would have been for gifts.
And that's largely been looked at as a correction of a mistake, because I don't think that the government was looking to penalize charities the way that they inevitably did. And so kudos for them. I mean, my least favorite thing, and it's, you know, not to talk about the policy, but just to talk about the incentives. I mean, they've launched the 30-year mortgage for first-time homebuyers only buying new construction, which I think is a terrible expectation to set for first-time homebuyers that they're going to get to buy a new house. And even worse, to say that in order to do it, we're going to let you take out a 30-year mortgage, which by definition means that they're going to be further stretched. So they were quite proud of this when they rolled it out, but I think that it's incentivizing a really, really bad situation. And I don't think that I'd ask anybody who was thinking about, hey, this is my key to the promised land, I'm going to do it, to be super, super careful, because it is, you know, in my opinion, advocating for a financial strategy that is really, really super dangerous and should be avoided.
So is it just, as I know we talked about this earlier, Colin, is it just new homes? Because I thought I saw something else that was talking about other scenarios where there could be an extended 30-year amortization on mortgages as well, under $1 million. Yeah.
Yeah, the only one I read was very explicit.
Yeah.
It had to be new builds. Yeah. And that was the program. I think it was talked about another. This is the 30-year mortgage has come and gone as far as a conversation in Canada about a way to deal with, you know, the issues that we're having now.
Well, was there, what, it was like 4 or 5 years ago, you could have a 30-year mortgage. So it has come and gone.
Yeah, no, it's drifted in and out. But I mean, recently I think Canada specifically, the Canadian consumer is so overstretched. There's been some legitimate worry about that. They've been ratcheting up the requirements for mortgages, which has been good. And this seems to roll back some of that. And aiming it at a group of people, and again, there's to an audience who's listening to that going, oh my God, I have to hold out and buy a new home because, you know, that's what first-time homebuyers do. It's like, that's not anything that you should expect. If it happens, great. But, you know, many, many people get started in a much more modest way into home ownership. So I was a little concerned about that. The other one that disappointed me, if you will, and this is kind of one of the ones that I'll beat the drum on, there was very, very little support for open banking. Open banking is one of the things they talked about going into this budget. And they set aside like $4 million or $5 million to study it or set up a group or something. It was mentioned, yay, but it was a bit of an afterthought and it didn't really have the gumption behind it that I was hoping, because that is something that would truly benefit the Canadian consumer to have the adoption of open banking. That would have been a big thing. So that was a bit of a disappointment. Because open banking would allow all kinds of services that are just not currently thought about. Now, they did go after NSF fees and a few other nuisance charges from the banks and rein some of that in, which is long overdue and a ham-fisted way of doing it.
Yeah, for me, the open banking thing would be a better way perhaps to accomplish some of those stupid fees and things like that you get dinged with, right? It just might be a little bit more of a competitive marketplace where you start to see some of those things naturally disappear rather than trying to legislate that.
Or just open up to foreign banks getting situated in Canada and introduce more competition. I mean, that could solve it too, right, Josh?
Maybe.
Too much to hope for?
That's a lot. That's a lot to ask for sure.
What else do we want to comment on? Matt, what was your next favorite thing?
Well, I mean, we talked a lot about how they're going to pay for things, but then the question is, well, what are they paying for? There's a big deficit that's a part of this, and housing seems to be one of the big initiatives for them. So housing is going to be funded by these extra taxes. I mean, how do we believe in their strategy to it, to adding more affordable housing and building more stock? Do we, what do we think about their approach here? If another deficit coming our way?
Well, I mean, again, from an individual's perspective, I don't think it really matters a hill of beans. Other than, it, for me, there's two things that matter at the end of the day to, you know, anybody in Canada. What is the strength of your social benefits? Now, Canada Pension is a fully funded pension. They did introduce some stuff in here which may put some pressure on that because they've increased some Canada Pension benefits. And it'll be interesting to see what the CPPIB comes out with as far as whether that affects their confidence in funding. But the CPP has always been a very consistent thing. But the OAS comes out of revenue. And, you know, to the extent that these basically perpetual deficits are going to cause, you know, financial stress down the road, I guess I would score it as being less likely. I would put less onus on expecting that the OAS as it exists today would exist for somebody who's going to retire in 10 years. Because it's one of the things that perpetual deficits is going to affect. So if I was going to take anything from that, then not passing any judgment on policy, I would be less confident that the OAS is going to be there in its current form, say 10 years from now. So if you're planning your retirement and that's part of your calculation, maybe take that out of your calculation or put it in there at a reduced amount.
Well, what do we think about the other taxes that are coming in as part of this? The digital services taxes, I may have that name incorrect, but there's a tax being applied to tech companies essentially. And then the digital services tax, and then a global minimum corporate tax also coming in. So are these a message to big companies that may be looking to set up shop here that it's not as friendly of a place to do business based on the cost to do business here? The new cost?
Yeah, I mean, that gets into, you know, the health of Canada as a country. I think the global minimum tax thing has been something that's been circulating the planet for years. And I don't think that's country specific because they're trying to get away from the tax haven thing so that, you know, companies that are countries that are actually generating the market for all of these products and services get to see some of the tax revenue out of it. The digital tax one, I didn't read anything on that one yet. I didn't get to that digital services tax. Is that something paid by the consumer on, or is that the company tax?
No, big companies, and retroactive as well. To what I read, to go back even not just 20, not this year, but they'll go back in taxes to be levied for prior years. So, you know.
Hey, Josh, what do you think? Is this going to be deflationary and take some of the pressure off the Bank of Canada? Like, do you think it's gone so far that it'll affect the decisions of the Bank of Canada?
Well, you've both brought up interesting points that would seem to be inflationary to me on the surface, right? Fairly substantial deficits still, and higher tax rates on various things. And I don't think they went quite as broadly as we would have expected or was rumored on the tax side of things, but certainly anytime you impose a tax on something, economic theory would tell you that the price of that thing is going to go up for the end consumer in some way, shape, or form. Yeah. So if you're taxing some of these digital services that previously haven't had a tax on them, then yeah, you'd expect that to be at least moderately inflationary at the end of the day. And same thing with the other taxes that they've imposed as well. So yes, making the situation more difficult for the Bank of Canada and their fight against inflation. They seem to have done a reasonably good job getting it under control, or it is coming under control, whether we can call that a good job by the Bank of Canada or not, I don't know. But it is coming under control, and this might make that inflation a little bit more stubborn. And we've already seen that over the last few months. So it's definitely you know, two forces pushing in opposite directions, I would say.
Just the other force that can improve inflation is productivity and growth in a country. And does this budget feel like one that is going to get to that area that's been so challenging in Canada, the area of productivity, where we have certainly been slipping for some time? I'm not sure even in a deficit scenario that we're really hitting an area that's just so important here in Canada is our waning productivity.
Well, yeah, and you start adding up, you know, the increased cost on capital gains, ostensibly making it less attractive to make a capital investment in a Canadian business. And, you know, the other measures that are taken in there to make things less hospitable, you know, that could slow down, you know, business growth in Canada and cause companies locate other places, which was to my earlier point to Josh, was that you know, maybe a few of these companies pull out and you know there's fewer jobs, which is going to lead to, again, helping maybe bring you know the economy under control, such as it were, and letting the Bank of Canada act quicker on the rate, the obvious rate cut that's coming this year, just like the obvious rate cut from last year. But you know, that's kind of an existential thing as to whether it gets to that level. But I don't think that this budget could be considered to be something that's aimed at improving productivity in Canada or improving global competitiveness. I don't think you know, anybody could construe it that way. It'll be interesting to see how the Bank of Canada reacts to this, both in real time and what the data is going to do changing going forward that'll cause the Bank of Canada to react.
Yeah, the rumors ahead of the budget were actually, I think, going to be a little bit more challenging even than this for the Bank of Canada, specifically on inflation, because I was hearing more about tax rates increasing more broadly for companies and potentially even having higher spending. So in a weird way, maybe TIFF's a little bit happy with this based on what was leaked there. It's like one of those things where you leak a bunch of bad news and then come in slightly better than expected and call it a win.
Hey, one of the other things that was kind of hidden in there is that they've provided more funding to Revenue Canada, get past that part, but they're going to pilot self-filing of tax returns or automatic tax returns.
Yeah.
You know, this summer. So I think that's a step that's long overdue. And it was nice to see that. And I do think that there's a lot of efficacy to that, especially for lower income earners and people in more simple situations to have an automatic option from CRA. Got to wait for the execution. I never have a lot of faith in their execution, but it's a nice thought. I mean, the thought's in the right direction. Execution can come second.
Yeah. Well call CRA center times are going to go way down too, eh? Yeah.
Son?
Call center times are going to go way down too. That's another thing that was in there.
That was mentioned. While everybody's good automatic tax returns, they're not calling in. So,
well, sure. CRA has 34% more staff since 2019, I just read. So one way or the other, I hope this means easier call center times and people get the tax done easier.
This is a really tough room for me to be happy about something. And you guys are just ready to jump all over it.
A couple minor positives that will affect a subset of the population. The disability support payments are in there. So they've first started by expanding access to the disability tax credit over the last few years. And now they're increasing the support payments that are available for those that are eligible for the disability tax credit. So I'd say that's a win. And something, it wasn't exactly clear how they're going to implement it, but it seems like it should be fairly straightforward. And then the other thing is there, and this one's going to be very confusing, I'm sure, but automatically opening RESPs for those that are eligible for the Canada Learning Bond.
I was waiting for you to get to that one.
Yeah. It seems like a stupid implementation, but the idea of making sure that the Canada Learning Bond is available for those that are eligible for it, I think is a very positive thing because these are in some cases individuals who wouldn't even consider opening an RESP if they're never going to deposit money to it.
Yeah. Well, no, and this is one of those ones that we should go back to because there's a bit of a, let's talk about trust disclosures. You know, there's lots of things that get announced as government policy through a budget or what have you that kind of go through the finance department. By the time it gets to CRA, it's just an unmitigated cluster gabble. And, you know, you're right, Josh. I'm with you. I think it's a spectacularly generous and right thing to set out to do. But the way they set out to do it is just so ham-fisted. It's like, how the Jesus are you actually going to pull this off and keep any of it straight? I can't imagine. So I guarantee you that somewhere there's a group of bureaucrats sitting in a room going like, what the hell do you want us to do with this? Like, there's no way forward.
Well, do you think that they asked any financial advisor on the planet when they decided to put this in place, whether the implementation was a good idea? Because the first thing I thought was, how are they going to do this? Yeah. Like, where are these RESPs going to be opened? So are they just going to pick a financial firm and then open them there? Or are they going to have a, you know, Service Canada type of... Yeah. RESP, it's crazy, but like a lot of things, end to end wasn't maybe executed as good as it could have been.
No, but yeah, and again, a part of it is our lens is we've watched things fall apart, and we've watched things very recently fall apart. So again, it's important to remember this is the budget, and it's got to go through a set of processes before it gets acclaimed. And know, some of this stuff is going to be different by the time it gets all the way through the process.
Yeah.
But Matt's looking at his notes. Did we miss anything, Matt?
Well, just another in that category of interesting idea that we'll wait and see how it gets executed. This employee ownership trust and the ability to transition a business to a group of employees who will own it through a trust, and you know, tax exemptions that come the way to the business owner. Sounds interesting, but let's watch one happen. Who's going to find, who's financing it? How's this going to work? So I don't want to be the first one to try and move this through, but it is an interesting idea. Just another option for a business.
This isn't new. This was announced two budgets ago, last budget. Like this is, I think that there's a new iteration. I think
there's further details.
Yeah. Because they haven't actually been able to pull one off yet. So it's like, they're taking another run at it.
Yeah.
And again, I'm confused because working with a lot of business owners over the years, I can't remember a situation where I really ever came across a situation that would fit this. You know, a founding business owner that has a group of capable, qualified, interested people that wanted to go through the quagmire of rules and regulations to set one of these up. It's one of those ones that, again, it sounds really, really wholesome, but, you know, it falls apart on the implementation.
Yeah, solution looking for a problem.
See, you know what? I talk for hours and hours and hours, and Josh just comes out with one pithy comment and sums up everything I had to say.
So. Yeah. Last thing I would highlight is they have made a couple changes to capital gains exemptions on selling a business, increasing the lifetime capital gains exemption from one to 1.25 million, give or take. What do they call it? The entrepreneur
incentive program. Yeah. I think they called it.
So if you're a founder of a business, you might get up to $2 million exempt from capital gains when you sell your business. Sorry, I shouldn't say exempt. It's a lower capital gains inclusion rate. But lucky for us, they've excluded finance companies and a number of other companies and almost everything that I can think of as a reasonable business.
Finance, insurance, hospitality, hotels, home care, private corporations, consultants.
Real estate.
Yeah, there you go.
Arts, I think, was in there too. Yeah, are we shitting on the arts? What did the arts do to anybody?
Who makes money at the arts?
If you made a capital gain in the arts, you deserve it. Take it. Tax free.
Anyway, no, but this is the danger, and this is, I guess, the reason we're spending this time at it. You know, the danger is, oh my God, capital gains are bad, and that's all people are going to hear, and they're going to run with it, and they're going to run to their advisors, and I'm terrified. I'm legitimately terrified right now what the next 6 months is going to hold for the kind of planning that's going to get thrown out there, and the number of people who are, when you're afraid, you're much more likely to go do something. Like, fear is a very powerful motivator. So hopefully this could do a little bit towards, you know, fighting back against, you know, some of those motivations out there. To Josh's point, to the Wall Street Journal, this isn't a big deal. To Matt's point, it's a big deal. So it really depends on how you're looking at it. From a planning perspective, this changes the math. May or may not be a big deal, but it does change the math. But it's not likely going to affect equity markets in any kind of a direct way.
Great way to sum it up.
So we're going to call this done.
If you're breaking a sweat trying to figure out what your financial advisor is talking about, you're not getting the service you need. You probably hate trying to get an answer from them, but you also think moving your accounts will be a headache, and it might be. But working with don'trocktheboatwealthplanning.com or .ru isn't exactly stress-free, is it? Call us. We will demystify the world for you.
Please note, the information provided in this podcast is for general information purposes only. It is not intended as financial, investment, legal, tax, accounting, or other professional advice. Our discussions are not a solicitation to buy or sell any securities or to make any specific investments. Any decisions based on information contained in this podcast are the sole responsibility of the listener. We strongly advise consulting with a professional financial advisor before making any financial decisions. Listeners should be aware that investing involves risks and that past performance is not indicative of future results. Bare Naked Money is produced by Varican Capital Management, Inc., a licensed portfolio management company in Canada. We operate under the regulatory framework established by the Provincial Securities Commissions in the provinces within which we operate. The views expressed in the podcast are our own and do not necessarily reflect the official policy or position of any regulatory authority. Remember, at Varican Capital Management, Inc., we focus on aligning our goals with yours, prioritizing integrity and transparency. For more information about us and our services, please visit our website. Thank you for listening, and let's continue to challenge the norms of the financial services industry together.